Hello, and welcome to the Climate Diplomacy Podcast, a podcast from Adelphi bringing you the latest insights and debates in international climate diplomacy. I am your host, Raquel Monayer, Climate Diplomacy Analyst at Adelphi. In this series, you will hear from leading experts offering their take on what needs to be done to promote climate foreign policy and provide you with the context you need to understand climate diplomacy today. For more information, please visit our website, climate-diplomacy.org, or follow us on Twitter under Climate Diplo. In this episode, we will speak about COVID-19, climate change, and security risks with the authors of the Climate Security Expert Network report, Spreading Disease, Spreading Conflict. Welcome Adrian Fong, Beatrice Musello, Christian Koenig, Emily Wright, and Susanne Wolfmeier from Adelphi. The pandemic offers an opportunity to talk about how interconnected risks, including those created by climate change, can contribute to insecurity and conflict. And taking these risks and their interconnectedness into account is essential, not just to build back, but to build back better. An expression you might have heard, and we will be talking about it today. This very timely report looks at the intersection of health, climate, and conflict risks, and it identifies four key pathways through which COVID-19 can exacerbate climate-related security risks. Now, you will get into each of these pathways later on, but first I'd like to outline them for our listeners. So pathway number one is increased pressure on livelihoods and resources. Pathway number two, reduced effectiveness of migration as an adaptation strategy. Pathway number three is weakened conflict responses and increased opportunities for non-state armed groups. And pathway number four, increased risks in urban environments and violent protests. Now, I'm curious to learn what stands behind those pathways. Christian Koenig is here with us today, and he's an analyst for climate diplomacy and security at Adelphi and one of the authors of the report. Christian, can you first describe and explain to us the idea of multiple burdens?
Thanks, Raquel. Very happy to start. So when we set out to write the paper, we knew from other climate security research that we will most likely see strong local dynamics for COVID-19 impacts. And that's something we really wanted to incorporate. We wanted to analyze the pandemic and its interaction with climate security in connection to local opportunities and pressures. And that's how we arrived at this idea of multiple burdens, which is really central to our paper. Essentially, we conceptualized that the pandemic is making it harder to respond to pre-existing and emerging challenges and worsens their impact. While at the same time, other events can also increase the disease burden. They can facilitate viral spread, lower medical capacities, or prevent and delay responses. And because those other events, those multiple burdens, are localized and regionalized, we can also expect specific local challenges. And so what are those multiple burdens, right? Well, climate change most certainly is one of them, but it also includes conflict, gender inequality, and economic hardship. So then in turn, what we analyze for the paper is instances where those multiple burdens have emerged, because unfortunately, they aren't just scenarios. Since the pandemic has hit, we've really seen them kind of come to the forefront in different places. So COVID made it much harder to respond to the locust outbreak stretching from East Africa to the Arabian Peninsula and India. In Sudan, violence and the pandemic have really strained an already fragile health system. We've had a serious hurricane season in the US, and Cyclone Amphan, which has hit India and Bangladesh, has harmed recovery plans and made it really difficult to prevent viral spreads because a lot of people were in shelters. And just to note again that unfortunately, the most vulnerable people in these scenarios are the poorest members of society. They've faced the largest impacts. So that's what we're looking at. That's kind of our process and our research question. How does COVID interact with other pressures in the climate security nexus, and in which situations might multiple burdens emerge?
Thank you for this overview, Christian. And now that we know what multiple burdens mean in this specific context, I'm curious to hear more about the impacts of COVID-19 and climate change on livelihoods and resources, which you described. Can you tell us a bit more about this?
Absolutely. So, as you said, Conflict and fragility can be worsened as climate change and COVID put stress on livelihoods. And the ability of individuals and communities to respond to similar impacts in the future, that is reduced because spending on adaptation is lowered or just missing entirely. And to go into a bit more detail, I mean, climate change especially impacts those in agriculture or depending on natural resources. And the pandemic much more broadly has kind of disrupted economies, disrupted employment, production and supply routes. But those impacts also have especially hit the informal sector, which employs a high number of women and girls. So these impacts are also heavily gendered, which a lot of people have brilliantly written on. So in terms of risk here, if those livelihood impacts, if they mix with pre-existing gaps in services, with weak governance or with marginalisation, all of which increase hardship, increase frustration with governance and which create or heighten community tension, in those situations when two things come together, conflicts over natural resources might emerge, increase or reappear, and tensions within communities and conflict within communities, that can also rise. And there is another risk here, because we do need to face that without stable livelihoods, many people will just need to look elsewhere for survival. And that can include illicit livelihoods. In Afghanistan, where climate change and conflict have undermined the viability and the lucrativeness of quite a lot of crops, people have turned to cultivate opium poppy, strengthening armed opposition groups and organized crime. And in this situation, if your priorities shift, if your income is lowered, you don't have surplus resources to spend on adaptation, you can't build resilience, your resilience is undermined, and in the future, you might be hit even harder. So I just want to close here with a quick note on the vaccine, because luckily we're on a really good path at the moment, but we also won't be returning to normality immediately, because until people are vaccinated and until economies have recovered, those livelihoods impacts unfortunately will continue in some form. I'll leave it at that. There's obviously more in the report, but also with my colleagues.
Thank you very much, Christian. That was very interesting indeed. I would now like to take a closer look on the second pathway of the report, which is about migration. Emily Wright is a consultant for climate diplomacy and international climate policy at Adelphi and a co-author of the report. Emily, could you please shed some light on the logic and interrelations behind migration as a coping mechanism for conflict and yet at the same time a potential risk factor for exacerbating conflicts?
Okay, well, thanks for the question. Well, basically, people have long used different forms of migration, be it permanent or temporary migration, migration within their country or abroad, seasonal migration, to cope with environmental change, and therefore to cope now with the impacts of climate change. And with the COVID-19 pandemic, lockdown measures and restrictions on travel and movement in place all over the world, that has meant that many of these migration strategies may no longer even be possible. Vulnerable people may be being trapped in places where their safety, their health, or their livelihoods are at risk. And for those that have already started using these strategies, it may render them less effective. So, for example, in rural farming communities where crop yields may be falling due to, say, changing rainfall patterns, drought, sea level intrusion in places in coastal areas affected by sea level rise, a common strategy has been for one or more members of the household to leave and to look for new ways of earning a living elsewhere, often in a town, city, or even abroad. And this isn't a small-scale phenomenon. For example, just to take Bangladesh, a country already experiencing severe climate change impacts, an estimated 400,000 people move to Dhaka, the capital, every year. And one study has estimated that as many as 80% of them may have environmental reasons for doing so. And then, of course, many Bangladeshis also work abroad and many other places, in the countries of the Gulf, for example. And when people leave, they often help their climate vulnerable communities in two ways, so the places that they've come from. Firstly, they relieve the pressure on food, water, jobs there. And secondly, they can send some of their earnings home in the form of remittances, where they can help pay for basic goods, maybe education, or even climate change adaptation measures such as irrigation systems. And now, with this year, with lockdown measures in place and work no longer available, many of these migrant workers were no longer able to send their remittances home, and they maybe even had to borrow money from their families to keep on surviving where they were.
And what does that mean for development?
This is likely to have had major repercussions for development, even at national level. In the summer, the World Bank predicted that remittances to low and middle income countries would decrease by 20% in 2020 due to COVID-19. And that amounts to a staggering $110 billion. Now, to put that in context, official overseas development aid, total ODA in 2018 was about $165 billion. And that isn't all. As well as no longer sending remittances, many migrants were also forced to return home. Some of them went to great and dangerous lengths to do so. There were reports in the early days of the pandemic in India of migrants working for days to return to their villages when the trains weren't running. Also, migrants abroad, for example, South Asian migrants in the Gulf, have been repatriated in huge numbers by their governments to prevent them from being stranded overseas. And now once home, that is a lot of people to reintegrate into these rural, climate vulnerable communities. And there's the potential for tensions to rise. That may be because the returnees have been stigmatized due to fears that they're bringing the virus with them when they return, or also because of this increased competition then for resources and jobs. So that's just a few ways, as you can see, that COVID-19 has interrupted established migration patterns and this key coping strategy for dealing with climate change impacts in these vulnerable communities. And these dynamics play out in very different ways in different parts of the world, but the common denominator seems to have been so far increased vulnerability for the migrants and their home communities that are struggling with climate change impacts.
Wow, Emily, thank you so much for clarifying the migration dimension to us. Another thing I was wondering about is why and how weak responses to the pandemic increase opportunities for non-state armed groups. This is the third of four pathways identified in the report through which COVID-19 can exacerbate climate-related security risks. Co-author Adrian Fong, analyst for climate diplomacy and security at Adelphi, is here with us. Adrian, can you tell us a little bit more about this?
Certainly, Raquel. I guess we can tackle this question in three levels. If we were to look at this in the short term, there has been a decline in armed conflict in some regions, especially in the first few weeks of the pandemic. And this is because a lot of these armed groups had to strategically cope with the restrictions on travel, on logistics and finances, although these were largely temporary. If we were to look a bit longer into the medium term, these travel restrictions could and have disrupted peace building and stabilization efforts. We've seen this playing out in parts of sub-Saharan Africa, for example, in the Abyei region between Sudan and South Sudan, and also in Somalia and Mali, where peacekeeping missions and security operations have all been disrupted due to travel restrictions, which of course is problematic as these operations require mobility to be effective. What is even more concerning is if we were to look at this in the long term. So as you've rightly pointed out, Raquel, many governments are struggling to provide essential services and other forms of livelihood support because of the pandemic, or they've had to reshuffle their resources around to tackle the pandemic, while sacrificing the resources that could have gone to other essential services, such as education and the maintenance of schools, for example. And as a result, we see several armed groups taking advantage of the so-called window of opportunity to increase their visibility, legitimacy, and support, basically by providing these very services that governments, at least in the face of the public, have failed to provide, especially healthcare. We saw this playing out in Afghanistan, for example, where the Taliban were actively providing public healthcare information and enforcing quarantine measures, while the government struggled to respond effectively to the pandemic. Also in Colombia, there were reports of organized criminal networks taking advantage of the government's lockdown measures and closures of public schools to increase their child recruitment, especially when the government's measures made it more difficult for civil society organizations to provide educational support for children in remote areas. Now, that is not to say that all armed groups follow this trend. On the contrary, some armed groups are against health measures, as they claim that such measures are against their faith and principles. One striking example is Boko Haram in northeast Nigeria, who claimed that the pandemic measures are an excuse to stop Muslims from practicing their faith. And as a result, there have been reports of Boko Haram disrupting the work of healthcare aid workers in the region. Now, this trend is equally worrisome, as this would disrupt efforts to combat not only the pandemic, but also to restore livelihoods, which, by extension, would make it harder for people to adapt to other stresses, such as climate change.
Thanks, Adrian. I think this is an aspect of the pandemic that probably many of us has never thought about. And now, both COVID-19 and climate change are particularly challenging for fragile cities. Susanne Wolfmeier is a consultant for climate diplomacy and security at Adelphi and has co-authored the report Spreading Disease, Spreading Conflict that we're discussing here today. Susanne, can you tell us what the interaction between climate impacts and COVID-19 could mean for the stability of urban areas?
Well, we see that COVID-19 brings an additional risk to cities and city dwellers. Especially in cities in fragile countries, the most vulnerable populations struggle to cope with the challenges arising from fertility and climate change already before the pandemic. And now urban areas are most affected by the spread of COVID-19. These health risks posed by the pandemic converge with already existing climate risks, including changes in precipitation patterns, flooding, and more extreme weather events such as cyclones. And this interaction affects in particular the urban poor, as they are more at risk from natural disasters, whilst at the same time the pandemic can hinder disaster response. For example, when Cyclone Amphan hit South Asia in May 2020, authorities were caught in the dilemma of having to decide whether to prioritize evacuation over distancing, so to take the risk to further spread virus in overcrowded shelters, or to put residents at risk of the cyclone in their homes. As we saw over the last month, the COVID-19 pandemic makes also inequalities in cities more visible and even widens differences. The economic impacts of COVID-19 are again especially severe for people living in informal settlements, where most find employment in the informal economy. Projections estimate that in Africa and Latin America, earnings in the informal sector decreased by around 80% in the first month of the pandemic. And these double burdens, the impacts of the pandemic and of climate change on living conditions, are particularly alarming, as worsening conditions in urban areas can increase the likelihood and severity of violence, as well as increased levels of crime. When we now look at a response side, we see that when government actions to the pandemic and a related lockdown fail, or are being perceived as failing, this may contribute to frustration and unrest. We saw, for example, unrest over the access to food during the pandemic in several cities around the world. And whilst many authorities provided water or food to the urban poor to prevent food riots, the access to food aid is often not equal for the poor. These trends could be exacerbated by the effect of climate change on food prices, which has already proven to be a factor for violent unrest in urban settings, such as, for example, those during the Arab Spring or in Sudan. So we see that the interplay between COVID-19 and climate change impacts poses a particular risk for fragile cities and the urban poor, as the pandemic hampers responses to climate change impacts and exacerbates resource stress and economic hardship. If local governments fail to design and implement responses that address both the risks arising from a pandemic and climate change impacts alike, these risks may finally contribute to urban violence.
Thank you, Susanne. This chain of interconnected risks reminds us of the multiple burdens that Kristin explained to us earlier. But the report goes beyond identifying risks. It also recommends a number of entry points that governments should consider to respond to the evolving risks we just heard about. To build back better from the pandemic and the climate crisis, there are a few things that governments can and should do. Co-author Beatrice Mosello is a senior advisor for climate diplomacy and security at Adelphi, and she will walk us through the following five recommendations. 1. Conducting integrated analysis of risks and vulnerabilities. 2. Moving to multi-sector and inclusive approaches. 3. Ensuring additional and long-term funding. 4. Connecting community level and global action. And 5. Making the case for multilateralism. Beatrice, could you please explain those recommendations in greater detail to us? What do they entail, and where do you see concrete opportunities for action?
Yes, of course. Thank you very much, Raquel. So what we realized during our research is that the COVID-19 pandemic has actually offered yet another opportunity to talk about how interconnected risks, including those created by climate change, of course, can contribute to insecurity and conflict. But also it's shown us how taking these risks into account is essential not just to build back, but to build back better, both from the pandemic and from the impacts of climate change. As you say, we have five key recommendations for governments and donors to do so. First of all, the importance of understanding the strong links between the impacts of COVID-19 and existing socioeconomic, political and environmental drivers of fragility and conflict, of which climate change is one. There would be important to invest in context-specific assessments that analyze climate and security risks, but with a specific focus on COVID-19 impacts. And, of course, very important that these assessments are informed by data that are segregated by sex, age, and other metrics, so that we can develop targeted responses that take into account the needs and vulnerabilities of different groups in society. Then we need to move to multi-sector and inclusive approaches. We've seen that these risks do not fit within the parameters of most existing institutions. So effective responses will also need to cross sectors, will need to cross policy areas. They will need to integrate health, climate, but also development, humanitarian, peace-building efforts, and cutting across several levels, from the local level to the national and regional, transnational one. I think a particularly interesting area here will be to look at opportunities for redesigning urban environments with a particular focus on informal settlements, I would say. So, for example, if we look at making informal settlements more climate-proof, for example, by investing in improved sanitation, that will also be an investment that can prevent the spread of diseases. Or if we design more open green spaces, we are not only supporting social distancing during the current pandemic or in view of future health crises, but we also help cool cities in summer and contribute to better air quality. Of course, none of these will be cheap. So governments and bilateral and multilateral donors will have to ensure additional and long-term funding. And I'd like to stress here the word additional, not just diverting resources from one area to the other, from climate change adaptation to COVID-19 responses, as it's currently happening, but adding some funding and potentially coordinating responses with other donors, other governments that are doing so. For example, I'm thinking of the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank that have already set up funding and investments to address COVID-19 related challenges in weak states, but also I'm thinking of those funds that specifically focus on climate change adaptation, such as the Adaptation Fund or the Climate Investment Fund. Another point I'd like to make is what we've seen, especially at the beginning of the pandemic, is that community level mobilization has played an important role in filling the gaps left by slow government action. For example, by improving hand washing facilities, delivering food supplies and protective equipment. And this actually reflects a larger trend of community-driven climate change mitigation and adaptation initiatives, which have really taken roots in many parts of the world in recent years. So I would say any efforts at building better should pay attention to these community level actions and organization and really focus on connecting them with global dialogues aimed at fostering cooperation. And last but certainly not least, the COVID-19 pandemic has been a stark reminder that its impacts, like the impacts of climate change, have a global reach. And hence the most effective solutions are through international cooperation and not through narrow nationalist agendas. Of course, governments have a first responsibility to implement responses to fight the impacts of the pandemic within their own borders for their own citizens. but their ability and willingness to work together towards a stronger and more inclusive multilateral system, drawing on the contributions, and this is key, of civil society, business, academia, and other sectors, will be critical, not just to address the current challenges, but to bring about systemic change towards more resilient and inclusive societies.
Thank you, Beatrice, and thank you to all the speakers of the Spreading Disease, Spreading Conflict report that joined us today. You made it clear that to build back better, we need to consider the interconnectedness of the risks you named and of the pathways you explained. But to put it in other words, not considering complexity and interconnectedness is precisely what drove us to have to deal with these inoperative systems in the first place. Holistic thinking, that's what separates quick fix solutions that backfire from long-term effective action. As was stated by UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres at the launch of the UN Comprehensive Response to COVID-19 in April 2020, coming out of this crisis will require a whole of society, whole of government, and whole of the world approach driven by compassion and solidarity. Almost a year later, and his statement is more relevant than ever. Funding and financial resources should not just be shifted, for example, from climate change adaptation and mitigation to fight the pandemic, but rather enlarged with additional funding. Efforts to build back better should not only focus on global multilateral action, but also pay attention to community-level action. Local and multilateral action should support systemic change towards more resilient and inclusive societies, which is needed to ensure long-term holistic and effective action to build back better. Thank you to our experts for giving us their insights on COVID-19, climate change, and security risks. Make sure to download the report, Spreading Disease, Spreading Conflict. We will be adding a download link in the episode description. And stay tuned. We will be back with another episode of the Climate Diplomacy Podcast in a few weeks. In the meantime, you can reach us with questions and feedbacks on our Twitter channel at Climate Diplo. Thank you for tuning in, and until next time, goodbye.